Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm, too. Live link to thetrumpet.com. Coming up today, winter weather just won't let go. Some storms coming into northeast United States could be pretty severe. A study on how nice people are and how nice they think they are. As daylight saving starts, which it did over the weekend, some people are asking, why should we fall back at all? And anti-Semitism in Europe and France on the rise. That and more coming up on this Monday edition. Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm, and a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. This is the Monday edition. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today. This is the Daylight Savings, first show since Daylight Savings. And I have to tell you, I do feel a little bit more tired than normal. I feel like I'm a little off.
Yeah, I definitely noticed it waking up this morning. And I was thinking to myself, you know, it's really an hour earlier. That's why. So I justified it.
Yeah, and I think we got all the clocks. That's always a thing, probably for a lot of people, is making sure you get all the clocks, because we usually forget one, and then I have that panicked moment of thinking it's a different time than it is. Sometimes it's a big relief because you have more time than you think, but other times it's not. So the nice thing about smartphones is they automatically update, which is great. And one thing I am very excited about is that over the weekend, our programming stayed on course the entire time here at KPCG.
Wow.
We remembered the daylight savings, planned accordingly, and lo and behold, it all worked out. So even if no one noticed, I noticed. And I'm happy about that. They did a story here from the independent.co.uk. It's a study they did. And they found out that people think they're nicer than they actually are. That surprise you, Grant? Do you think that people would actually think they're nicer than they are?
Probably, yeah. I mean, people don't like to admit they're wrong either, or that they've done something that would frustrate someone else or inconvenience someone else. So they would rather think more highly of themselves, I'm sure.
That's probably true across the board. I would doubt that you'd find somebody who thinks, boy, I'm just a really terrible person, but they're great and everybody loves them. Like, those two things, I don't know. Maybe that would occur, but it doesn't seem like it would. So they looked at this. They asked people some questions to try to determine how nice they were. The questions are interesting because I don't know that it totally equates to being nice, but they did find, too, that nice people earn more money. So if you want to raise, you're supposed to just be nicer in general. I could see that. I mean, obviously, I mean, people prefer nice people, so you like to work with them.
Yeah, my experience sometimes at certain jobs I've been at, I wasn't as skilled as the person ahead of me or for promotion or that kind of thing, but the employers wanted to promote me or give me their job because I just got along better with the employees in general, and that they, I guess, valued that more of an asset than the other person was faster, better skilled, but there's always arguing or causing problems. So I guess that's a huge asset for a company long term.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely it is. When I was in high school as a senior, we had the option to work if we wanted part days, if we had taken enough courses. So I did that. But it was also part of a class, and you had to, at the end of the class, we had to write or talk about what the biggest thing we learned was from working at an actual company in the world. And that was what I said, that you have to get along with people. That was the biggest lesson I learned, because if you got along pretty well, you could usually do okay. But you'd always see that, you know, you'd see a little inner office bickering or fighting or things, and that always slowed things down. So it's very important to get along. What about the pizza place? You get along at the pizza place, Grant?
I was kind of a loner there, actually. I got along with people, but I didn't fit in. I didn't really find my niche there. I sort of just worked hard and didn't talk to people that much.
Yeah, I see. Well, you know, sometimes that's better than going the other way with it. You know, you're going to have situations where yeah, I'll just keep to myself.
Well, there were some wild and crazy people who worked there, so that was sort of by choice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess especially, it was probably a lot of younger people, teens and stuff, so you're going to have a lot of, you'll have interesting situations that occur. Yeah, sometimes better to step back a touch. This study that tried to determine how nice people were given a list of quote-unquote nice behaviors and asked which ones they do. So I guess honesty policy here. The most frequently carried out gestures were giving directions to strangers, holding doors open, and giving up seats on public transport. Those were the things that people said they did the most. Related story to that, this woman, I saw a headline last week, I think it was somewhere in the East Coast, I think it was a subway. She's a pregnant lady, and she carried a trophy with her for, it was like she called it like the nice guy trophy or something like that. And the first guy that got up and offered her the seat she was going to give the trophy to, some sort of social experiment. So it took a while, but a guy finally did, and he got the trophy.
Awesome.
He was a nice guy. He gave up the seat. However, 2/3 of people in this study admitted that they rarely ever help others with carrying heavy shopping bags. 5/6 infrequently give money to strangers. I don't think I'd give money to strangers either. You just don't know what they're doing. And only 1/4 of people... help the elderly or infirm people across the road often. So that would be interesting. It'd be an interesting situation. You know, they might be afraid just going up somebody being like, I'm going to help you across the street. They're like, whoa. You know, you'd have to be careful with that, I guess. If they needed help, I guess that would be good.
Yeah. It's, I think, you have to use wisdom in any circumstance. Sometimes people don't want help. I know sometimes I've asked people if they need help and I come across as patronizing them. And they feel insulted that I think they need help when they don't.
That's
so
true.
I can just completely misjudge the situation and actually insult them by trying to be nice. So it's, sometimes I think I'm pretty nice. I'm like, oh, I think that person appreciated that. My wife's like, no, you did that. You completely messed it up. I'm like, really?
Well, that's a third category. The guy that's trying to be nice and he keeps failing. The nice guys, those are the nice guys that finish last.
That's true.
That they always talk about. Well, that's why it's good. It's good to have somebody you can talk to, a wife or a confidant of some kind where you can ask them, like, how did I do in that situation? Did I nail that? And they're like, oh, no, that was horrible. Yeah. Got to have a second opinion, I guess. So what they did also with this study is while they asked people to fill out this questionnaire or they asked them the questions about do they do these nice things, they had their faces hooked up to some sort of expression reader to see how they like responded to the questions, and they tried to pair that data together and see if, you know, what they were saying actually seemed to correspond to their facial expression. That's kind of a dicey thing. I don't know that you can totally tell that, but it was interesting. And so the study found out that in general, most people thought they were a little nicer than they were. They rated themselves. Most people didn't rate themselves the nicest, but they went second level. Which everybody would do, you know.
Yeah.
Are you perfect? Well, no, but I'm pretty close. And they believe that they were overestimating their niceness in general.
Oh. Yeah, actually, I don't think I've ever been across a lot of those situations that they're talking about. Giving money to people is pretty rare. I don't think I've ever seen an elderly person trying to cross the street where I've been.
Right.
And so I've never had a chance to do that anyway.
Yeah, some of these seem a little... older, like in terms of something that maybe would have happened years ago, and I haven't seen too many situations like this where it would occur. And you know, the thing too is that I think for a lot of people, and I kind of fall into this category, you know, sometimes you'll see something and you think maybe I could help there, but you're not sure what the situation is, and you don't want to get into a bad situation, because unfortunately sometimes people set things up like that. You know, if you see somebody with a flat tire, do you stop and help? It depends. And also today, smartphones are a big thing. In most cases, people can it's not like, oh, they need to get to a phone or something, because everybody carries phones. You can call the police. You could call, you know, your buddy to come help you. So it's a little different world in that way. And I think people are a little more hesitant because they're afraid of being taken advantage of. And I can understand that too.
Yeah, it's really important to just be discerning, because people have gotten so advanced with the way that they deceive others now. I mean, it can be really dangerous to help people, even when you had good intentions the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how high I would rate myself on the niceness scale. I probably sadly would fall into the category of most, where I'd be like, oh, second level, second highest level. I'd be like, oh, no, sir, not even close. But so that was interesting. Yeah, but they did find, too, that if people in general were a little bit nicer, they were healthier, they were happier, they did better on the job, what you'd expect to find, I think. If you're positive, then it brings positive results with that. So that's an interesting study there. It's from the independent.co.uk. And that'd be interesting technology to have your face hooked up to the face reader. We all do that, don't we? If somebody's saying something to you, you do kind of look at their expression or their our expressions betray us sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes you try so hard to not let your expression betray you that it still does. Your face will be stiffened up because you're not trying to give away any certain emotion, and that itself gives something away.
Yeah, you psych yourself out.
Yeah.
Yeah, the hardest is suppressing laughter. If someone's, they're doing something really important, they slip up a word or they say something they didn't mean to.
Right.
It's just really hard not to laugh or chuckle, especially if it's a more solemn moment or an important moment. That, to me, that's, because I think my face generally lacks emotional expression anyway, but usually the laughing is what gets me. Because I just accidentally burst out laughing, like, oh, I probably shouldn't have done that.
It's so easy to tell what laughs have been turned into a cough. Like, people try to say, go like, it's obvious, and you can't get away with it.
And in most cases, the cough generates more attention than just the laugh would have. I find that the older I get, the easier it is to kind of control that. But when you're younger, like a teenager or something, it is really hard.
You get infected by the giggles.
Yeah.
You can't stop. That still happens to me rarely, actually.
Yeah.
Worst times.
But, and like you said, Abraham, I mean, especially if you know you shouldn't, like, do not laugh at this moment, then you can't help it. I don't know why that is. That's the other thing that's hard about expressions is sometimes somebody will tell you something, probably a little harder for guys, I would think. They tell you something and they're expecting a certain expression, and they're expecting it to be kind of big, you know, like, I've got great news, you know, and sometimes I have a hard time. I know what I'm supposed to do, but I have a hard time making my face do it. I feel like I'm like it's insincere or something. I don't know. It, probably different for different people.
Right. Yeah, that's the other thing. If someone tells me great news, or recently a friend of mine was engaged, and they were visiting with my wife when I came home from work, and they're good friends, and I was talking with them. My wife's like, oh, look at her ring. I'm like, it's nice. I mean, congratulations.
Right.
I don't know. To me, I'm not the kind of guy to other people have better things to say about your ring than anything I could come up with or think of at that moment. So. But yeah, I think they expected me to be like, oh, like amazing ring, but that's not,
it's not you.
Yeah. It's not me.
You can fall into the other side of it too, where you really try to say something and then you think, oh, why did I say that? That didn't even make sense. It didn't even work. It's like the game of golf. You get a mulligan, you know, can I get a mulligan on that? A social mulligan where I could do that again and do it better next time. But that, I guess the funny thing is that happens to everybody. So we're all in good company with it. Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Those are coming your way here in a bit on KPCG. Also, make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com. It is new and updated and revised. One of the feature stories today is German Army back on German streets for the first time since World War II. You can check that out and some related stories as well at thetrumpet.com. Grant, you've got an interesting story for us. Daylight Savings Time is here, at least in this area. New York Times, as daylight savings starts, some people ask, why should we fall back at all?
It's amazing how just 1 hour of a time change can actually throw off so many different things. And now a lot of states in the Northeast are looking into possibly staying on Atlantic Standard Time, which is actually an hour ahead of Eastern Standard Time. But the thing is, there are so many ramifications to that. For example, if you live in Connecticut, the northern half of Connecticut, a lot of those people commute to Massachusetts for work. And the southern half commutes to New York City for work. The thing is, New York City wouldn't be changing, but Massachusetts might. So depending on where you live or where you work, you might be 1 hour behind in New York or 1 hour ahead in Massachusetts, but you live in the same place.
That would be, wow, what a confusing life that would be. Yeah. You'd have to have your double clocks and be thinking that way all the time. That'd be very, very confusing. It's just kind of an example, I guess, of where man starts to dabble with laws and things, and it just gets more and more confusing down the way. There'd be all kinds of ramifications. I have heard of that where people their houses are actually split between time zones. Mm-hmm. They just happen to live right there.
That's amazing. And that's amazing.
And I, you know, they obviously find some way to do it. It's not like they do, you know, they, I want to gain an hour. I'm going to walk into the bedroom, you know, so, but it is bizarre. Yeah. What would you do if you had to work at a place that was a different time, you know, than where you lived? It would be very confusing.
Yeah. And it really does seem to change every aspect of life after that, because then it determines when the buses come to pick up the kids or when you have to drop off your children, whether you're working an hour ahead somewhere or an hour behind. Your schools back at home in Connecticut are still going to be running at the same time. So it could get a bit complicated there.
What is the positive side, they think? Just that they'd have more daylight to do more things?
Or? Right. In places like Maine especially, the sunset can come like 3:45 in the afternoon whenever they spring forward. And so that really – or whenever they fall back.
Right.
Yeah. So that can be a bit complicated. You know, like anyone who keeps the Sabbath would know, on Fridays, if they're living over somewhere like that, they'd have to get off early – every single Friday.
Yeah, a lot of places up north it gets pretty early. I think the earliest we got up in Wisconsin, I want to say it was like 4:15 or 4, somewhere in that vicinity. And so, yeah, it does change things depending on your schedule and what you're doing. But I don't know. I would just kind of rolled with it. There are some places like in Alaska, you know, obviously, where they have times where the sun doesn't really set, and then they have times where it's dark for a long, long time. Some pretty extreme places like that. Is it gaining momentum? I mean, do they think they're actually going to change some of the times officially?
It looks like they have a lot to go through, but New Hampshire has already, I believe, passed a resolution on it in the House, and I believe it's contingent on whether Connecticut and Massachusetts and Maine and some of these other states also agree to do the same thing. They believe it would gain a lot more traction and be a lot more credible nationally if they did it as a group instead of individually, and then that way they could get some sort of regulation from the federal government that would allow them to legally jump an hour ahead.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't really aware of this Atlantic Standard Time Zone. I hadn't heard much about that.
Yeah, it's basically like the U.S. Virgin Islands, some parts of far eastern Canada, like maybe Nova Scotia might be out there that ahead of Eastern, because if you look on the map even, it is a little bit farther to the east than any of the eastern states would be.
Okay. Yeah, sadly, I think I base it all on TV schedules.
Right.
Like games. Like, what time is that? Is that Eastern or is that, you know, that's kind of how I tend to think about it.
That's actually mentioned in the article, too. Like, sports schedules would be complicated depending on if you were a Boston sports fan or a New York sports fan living up there. You have to make sure you remembered what time was being listed for a game if you wanted to go. Things like that.
Yeah, well, it is interesting how we just get used to a certain routine, whether it even be something like a sporting event. And then if you go, say, to the West Coast, you know, and you have, say, on Sundays, NFL games starting at like 10 in the morning.
That's actually ideal.
Paradise.
That sounds fantastic.
But I remember being a kid, and we took a trip out there. That was the biggest thing that impressed me in terms of differences. I was like, they're starting at 10 a.m.?
Yeah,
out there
in the West on the West Coast, it seems the most convenient because, I mean, they don't have to stay up till 2 a.m. to watch things. It's either their time or it's happening earlier, and they can not have to compromise sleep to watch whatever they want.
Yeah, that is a big issue that comes up even for those teams because of their revenue and such. And the East Coast teams complain that when they go play in the West, you know, their fans can't stay up and watch it. They're not going to stay up till, well, some will. The diehards will, but a lot of them won't. Yeah, it is always interesting when the clocks change. Doing it just an hour for, you know, most of us, it doesn't take too long until you get used to it and you're kind of used to the schedule. But I have wondered in the past, too, what if they just went more? If we went 2 hours, see what happens. Eventually, I guess you'd flip day and night around and everybody would be discombobulated.
Right. It would take a lot of adjusting, too. And that just seems to be the main complaint for people who want to change to Atlantic Standard Time an hour ahead of Eastern, is that they don't like it being pitch black already before they've even gotten off their work shift at 5, or even kids pretty much getting out of school when it's already dark. You know, there's things like that they don't like that I guess you can adjust to, but sometimes an inconvenience can annoy you so much that you want to just change the actual time of where you live.
They're being triggered by the darkness. I want to change the time zones. Well, you do hear about that, especially, say, for people that move to, like, Portland and areas like that where it's, you know, or Seattle where it's cloudy a lot and dark a lot. Sometimes that does really affect people, the way they think and their moods and that. And some don't. It doesn't bother at all. So, yeah, I can totally understand to some extent how it's dark all the time. It starts to kind of mess with you a little bit. But, again, it's you can only adjust it so much with time changes because you're not getting any more daylight. It's just how you're trying to structure your day around it, I guess.
Right. It does. It's all about you have the same 24 hours in a day. It's just a matter of what hours are dark and what hours are not. I mean, you could still be awake during dark hours because we have technology now that gives us light and we don't have to light a candle or anything like that. So it's not really that complicated, except for sometimes your mind might trick you into thinking, well, it's dark, I should go to sleep now, even though it's 5:30.
Yeah, it is interesting to think back to when, again, there wasn't electricity and you didn't have lights, artificial lights and such. And sunset, that's kind of it. I mean, you could light a candle, I guess, like you said, but, you know, I don't know. It seems like that was kind of it for people. There wasn't a lot to, you know, to keep you up beyond when the sun went down. That would be really strange. You get a lot more sleep.
Right.
A lot more sleep.
Right. Yeah, that's what seems to happen every time. Every time I go camping in the wintertime, it's already dark by 5:30 or 6. And then, so I feel like I'm staying up super late when it's 8 o'clock. So then you just go to bed and you sleep really well and feel refreshed and get up the next morning earlier than you normally would as well.
So we'll see if they actually do change this and give people a little more daylight up there. Well, make it seem like there's more daylight. That's at the New York Times. As daylight saving starts, some ask, why fall back at all? It is hard to keep it straight. You always have to spring forward, fall back, try to keep it in mind. But interesting article. Grant, thanks for bringing that into us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online also at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. And I appreciate you joining us today in this Monday edition. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today with you. And Abraham, you've got an interesting write-up. There's some pretty fascinating new technology that they're displaying at this South by Southwest festival. And this write-up is from The Verge. Sony's touchscreen projector technology feels like the future of interactivity. How does it work?
Yeah, this is really awesome. It's probably the closest we've gotten to something you'd see in Iron Man, like the holograms and that kind of thing. And it's really brilliant ideas, and it's actually very practical as well. And so Sony, they've developed two different kinds of projectors. And basically the idea is these projectors on the field that they're projecting on, so where the light's hitting the flat surface, using 3D sensors and different motion detectors, they can turn that surface into a touch screen. And then the projector will react to your hand movements and different things like that. The first kind of projector, it's an overhead projector, and it projects down on a surface. And basically, it can put on like a pattern or like a map or something like that. And you can grab things on it, move your hand across, and you actually move the objects that are being displayed by the projector. Or you can put 3D objects on the table, and the projector will read them and then turn them into part of the landscape. One example they have of that is, say, a house design. They put a house flat on the table, and they put a wooden block on there that's the same shape as the house. And if you turn the block of wood, it will also turn the projection of the house as you turn the block of wood.
Oh, I gotcha.
And they had another example where they had Alice in Wonderland. They had like a map of it, and you could grab the characters on the map and move them around. But they're not there. They're just projected onto the surface.
Yeah.
But it can read your hand movement. So it actually turns whatever the projector screen is into a touch screen.
Yeah. The audience must have been amazed by that. It kind of reminds me of the old Apple reveals where people would ooh and ah. You know, you don't get a lot of that anymore because we've seen most everything to this point. But something like this is new. It is, like you say, sort of you see it in movies where they can move things around, and that's always what the future looks like, I guess.
Right.
But they're actually doing it, so that's pretty fascinating. The example of the house, that's a pretty good one because you could see where in a presentation or something, if you were trying to, you were an architectural firm and you're showing your client what the building is, well, that'd be pretty fascinating, or let them move it around. I imagine there'd be a lot of, beyond it just being neat, I bet there'd be a lot of really good applications for this.
Yeah, that's the great part of it, is actually practical technology. Some of the things that they come up with are just in the infant stages and they're not practical yet. This is something that a house designers can use, even car designers, any type of architect, even any kind of person who's involved with geography. You can actually use make like a interactive map that you can teach on or demonstrate certain things on. So that makes it really exciting, I think, just to, for presentations and for teaching purposes. You can just make it a lot more clear. Rather than using slides or something, you can actually move things around with your hands. And it happens real time. And so they're really excited about that. It's called projector-based touchscreen technology. And then there's a second kind of projector, and this one is pretty neat as well. Basically, if there's this projector, it's not an overhead projector. You put the projector on the peak of a slanted surface. So if a table is slanted a little bit, you put it at the very edge of the table where it's the highest point is, basically. And then it will project light onto the table in different forms, such as like piano keys, drum pads, anything like that.
Right.
And you can actually play instruments because it will read your hand hitting the different keys, and you actually make music or play instruments just from light hitting any kind of surface.
That's pretty amazing. You could, I mean, I'm sure there'd be a lot of maybe resistance on some levels by like a musician, because it's not the real exact thing. But if you were, I guess, traveling and you needed to play music somewhere or something, I mean, how great would that be to just bring a surface or have a surface there and just project your instruments? You could just carry it in your pocket, or however big the projector is, not that big, I'm sure, and have whatever you need there. If you brought a band with you, you could just bring a few projectors. I mean, I could see that having some really great applications too.
Yeah, exactly. And even just for having fun, you could just do music or even game consoles might capitalize on this, like with Guitar Hero and all that type of thing.
When both of the projectors, that's one of the first things I thought of, is that what will probably really drive it will be video games.
Right.
Which is going to have its pros and cons. But if you have a projection screen that reads your movements, you could see them putting that into a video game to where you are the character in the game and you stand in front of it and you move, and then you it's kind of like a Wii, only just more advanced, I guess. So, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I don't know. It could go a lot of ways, but I would see that. That would be one of the industries. I think it would really drive it.
Yeah. Yeah, same thing with VR technology, virtual reality. They've already developed a bunch of games with that, and it's pretty amazing what it allows you to do, but so immersive. It probably has some bad side effects. Basically, you become the character and you're moving around.
Right.
But with this, though, I think it could help. They think it could help with musicians, or as they develop, especially the one where it projects a surface, you can make music or different things on. It could open up new avenues of just being able to be able to travel lighter and just have a lot more options, especially for work and business, and just make things a little more virtual. And it looks like something from a sci-fi movie, like Star Trek, where it's advanced displays and you can move them around. So I think this really is exciting for interactivity and that sort of thing, and how it could even revolutionize education, just make it a lot more visual and easier to understand.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see what they do with it. As with all things, technology advances. Usually there's some good things and there's usually some things that aren't quite as great with it. But it's pretty amazing they could do that. So that's some new technology there from Sony, a touchscreen projector technology, feeling like the future of interactivity. You could think about if you were working in an environment where you were doing that all day, like what that would do to your senses.
Yeah.
That would be, I don't know, that'd be interesting. Probably wouldn't be great, I'm guessing, if you had to do it all the time. But who knows? We'll see what they do with that. You've got a history story for us here as well. There's quite a few news stories today. There have been over the past few months and even years about the movement of anti-Semitism in Europe and France. And but as you see here, and as you're going to point out, it's not a modern phenomenon, but rather it's a deep-rooted part of European history, and it's kind of happening again over there.
Yeah, I thought with today there was a story from a German newspaper. It's a couple tabloids from Hamburg saying that Netanyahu is as bad as Khomeini in Iran. He's one of the seven worst world leaders, and they compared him with Mugabe and other dictators. And then there's some other stories where in France, some Jewish synagogues were under threats of violence. And there have been plenty of terrorist attacks against Jews in France in the last few years. Those two Jewish children that were killed, I think, 2 or 3 years ago is the main one I think of. But with anti-Semitism, I think we're surprised it's still around, especially, and anti-Semitism lives in the shadow of the Holocaust in modern European history. And I think most people view anti-Semitism as maybe a unique event with Hitler, that Hitler brought it about. The Holocaust was a terrible event, but it was so unique it couldn't happen again. Or with the defeat of the Nazis, anti-Semitism is gone. But that's not the case at all. And when you look at European history, there are, of course, some great achievements, but there's also this lurking darkness in European history. It doesn't matter what country, it's in almost every country, and that is anti-Semitism. And so it's interesting to look back at how centuries of keeping that around can lead to these tragic events, like the Holocaust or other smaller ones. A big reason why is that is the relationship of Judaism with Christianity, because they are competing religions. When you have when the Catholic Pope and the Protestants and other, these religious powers are very powerful in politics, they would influence leaders to try to degrade the Jews because of religious jealousy, basically. And because the Jews were very prominent in society, they felt very vulnerable to them. So that's part of it, is that there's this religious confrontation between Judaism and Christianity over the centuries. So that's part of why Europe has this in it, is because most of Europe is Christian, and there's just that natural enmity between the two groups. But another part of it is that usually European leaders need a scapegoat. Most leaders choose to blame something instead of accepting the responsibility. And for most of European history, the Jews were the scapegoat, the convenient one. And I think what's really interesting is there was a Jewish writer named Benjamin Taluda during the second century AD, so in the 1100s. He traveled around Europe and went to Baghdad in the Middle East, and he wrote a journal of everyone he encountered. And it's really illuminating because it shows that at that time, around the 1100s AD, so right after in the Crusades, Jews were actually better treated in the Islamic countries than they were in Europe. And I think for us, that's hard to understand because today of all the violence between terrorist networks and the Jews in the Middle East, that we find that maybe hard to believe. But at that point in history, Jews were treated better in the great Islamic empire than they were by Europeans in a Christian civilization. And I, in Baghdad, when this Benjamin Taluda got there, there were 40,000 Jews living in Baghdad who were well treated. They were very powerful in the court of the caliph, and they had all the rights and everything that could be expected. And when he was traveling in Europe, most of the Jews were very disrespected. They were segregated from the rest of European society. And I think it's just a good example of how old anti-Semitism is, but also that anti-Semitism can explode on any society at any time. That the Islamic people were much more tolerant back then, but today we kind of see a switch of that. And so I think it's just a warning that anti-Semitism is a very old hatred, and it can resurface very suddenly given the right circumstances.
Yeah, and it seems like, especially with modern history, it's kind of like the first layer of hostility. Because, let's say, with the Nazis, for example, I mean, they obviously they had a real hatred there for the Jews, but it didn't stop there. I mean, there were lots of people also brought into those camps. And if they had been successful, where would it have stopped? You know, they wouldn't have treated anyone well other than, I guess, maybe their own. But even that, they didn't after a while. And so while they always, it seems like they do take the brunt, the Jews take the brunt of some of the first hostilities and conflicts, it's usually a good indication that there's bigger problems boiling as well between, you know, religions and nations and that type of thing. So it's a warning sign when you see things like that, not just obviously for the Jews, but I think for society in general, because it means there's a lot of hatred out there under the surface and sometimes not so under the surface.
Yeah, usually they're the first group attacked, but they're definitely not the last one, like you said. It's just usually it's just they're the first victims of a huge movement of trying to repress liberties or to really oppress certain groups of society. And what's really interesting in Europe is that some of the greatest empires, some of the leaders that they hold to the greatest standards, like men like Charlemagne, the great Frankish king, very anti-Semitic. Even Edward I, the king who brought the stone to England in 1296, he was very anti-Semitic. Part of it is it was a cultural thing. So all these kings of Europe, they all did it because it was culturally expected of them, even if perhaps they didn't have any personal enmity against the Jews. So there's that side of it. But what I think is interesting is that if we forget about the history of anti-Semitism with all these leaders that we're praising today, like Charlemagne, maybe Edward I or some other leaders, especially in Germany, that was the center of it, unfortunately, for a long time in European history. If we forget about that past, then it's easier for it to happen again, because we fall into the same cycles. And so if we're trying to recreate something like Charlemagne had, if Europeans are trying to build an empire like Charlemagne had, it's probably going to have some of the same problems Charlemagne's did, and that part of it was anti-Semitism.
And that's what's so strange about the time we're in today, and of course there's a lot written at thetrumpet.com about this, but because America has not been a good ally to the Jews in Israel, and you know, maybe there's a little bit of change there with the current administration, but I don't know how much, they are having to go to somebody that traditionally hasn't been an ally, which is Germany, because you do have you have Iran on one side persecuting them. America hasn't been a huge help, especially lately. And they're in a very volatile area of the world. A lot of people want Jerusalem. A lot of the religious religions want Jerusalem as their capital. And so they need help. And so where are they going? You know, now you see it, and you're going to see it more and more, and you can read about it at thetrumpet.com. They're going to go to Germany for help, which is strange. It's the last place you think you would go, but they're kind of pushed into that direction.
Yeah, exactly. And it's you can really see how the Jews in Israel are in an impossible position, surrounded by their enemies, surrounded by terrorist networks. Even the United States, the number one group targeted by hate crimes in the United States are Jews. I think over 75% of hate crimes in the United States are against Jews, and there are thousands of these incidents every year. So even in America, there's widespread anti-Semitism as well. Not as widespread as it used to be in the 1930s. Even in Britain during World War II, Winston Churchill had to fight against his own cabinet to try to protect Jews escaping the Holocaust, because it was culturally acceptable to be anti-Semitic in some degree. So that's recent history. Those are the allies. Those are the good guys that had the battle against anti-Semitism. So when you're dealing with Germany today, of course, people can change, and Germany has done a great job trying to reinvent its identity. But I think in the end, as Bible prophecy shows, as everything written on thetrumpet.com shows, the new identity of Germany is not enough to overcome its old cultural traits, its history of culture. And unfortunately, that does include anti-Semitism. And so with the terrorism attacks by Muslims against Jews in Europe, but also just of native Europeans against Jews in France. France has been the center of it lately, but it's also spreading to other places. We can see how I think in the last few years, more Jews have migrated out of Europe to Israel the most since the Holocaust. So Jews are fleeing Europe because it's becoming repressive. But that's who the Israeli government needs to go to for help. So you can see how when the foreign, when public opinion intervenes in these European governments, people not really liking the Jews that much probably, you can really see how it might affect their judgment, their policies, and not really be that favorable to Israel. And how the backstab in Bible prophecy can take place where the allies of the Jews actually turn against them at the very end.
Yeah, the world is changing as far as its alliances and so forth. But they always kind of fall back to where they've always been in a lot of ways, you know, Europe, Asia, and so forth. And so, and then you have some people caught in the middle,
yeah,
unfortunately. So interesting look at some of that. And of course, there's a lot written about what you can expect to see happen in those regions and all around the world at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you stop and check that out today. Also coming up today on KPCG, the Key of David program here in a bit, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, just the best literature. We have Watch Jerusalem today and Music for Life. So a lot of great programs here today on 101.3 KPCG. That's all the time we have on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live, this Monday edition. Hopefully you're having a great Monday. Thanks for joining us. Myself, Dwight Fault, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau. Have a great rest of your Monday, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.